To the Iowa Blog. I am your host, Craig Wim. The purpose of tonight's program, and it is another live stream, also to Facebook, is that the most important thing for us to share, for you to know, is Yahweh's name. And we did three programs on this previously, but unfortunately, we were rookies at the audio portion of our programming, and it was garbled. And I know that Yahweh chose Moshe to tell us his name, and Moses admitted that he had a speech impediment, so God doesn't seem to be troubled by the fact that all systems are not ideal when it comes to sharing his name with his people. But nonetheless, it is far too important for us to relegate to audio that was less than ideal. And therefore, this evening, I'm going to begin where we began now a couple of weeks ago and share with you how we know for certain that God's one and only name is Yahweh, that this is how it's pronounced. I will share with you how we came to know this, and that God's name, Yahweh, is his only name. And the only way he wants to be remembered and recalled for all time. The story begins with Moshe. The name means one who draws out. He is called Moses because of a Greek transliteration of Moshe. But his name is Moshe. The name is important because, like so many names that are part of God's story, his name has meaning. And in this case, Moshe's principal role was to call God's people out of the torment they were enduring in Mitzrayim, the crucibles of human oppression. Now, before we begin, a word about this man. Moshe was the only qualified person on earth to perform this mission. God chose him because he had experienced the horror of the religious and political, economic and military culture of Mitzrayim. He had been adopted into Pharaoh's royal household. He knew the fraud that the Pharaoh was perpetrating on his people. It's the same fraud that every king and queen throughout the world has perpetrated on their subjects as well. They claim divine authority. They even claim to be gods. They claim to be infallible. They claim to own everything and have no shame in ruling over everyone's life. But nonetheless, they are completely wrong. And Moshe knew it. One day he saw a taskmaster among the Egyptians beating a Hebrew man to death. And he intervened. To save a life of an innocent person, he risked his life and got between the taskmaster and the man he was beating to death. And in the process, the Egyptian taskmaster died. When Moshe was next seen by the Hebrews that he had done something amazing in the sense that he had stood up for them, risked his own standing, risked his own life to protect them, they turned against him. They mocked him. They said, "Who are you to do such things?" And so Moshe really had no choice. He left Mitzrayim and he headed to Arabia. And this is what made him not only the ideal candidate for this mission, but the only candidate. Because God chooses to work with those individuals who have walked away from the influence of politics and religion. Moshe had not only walked away, disassociating himself from the religious schemes of Mitzrayim, Egypt, and its politics. He knew them. He despised them. And that meant that Yahweh could spend all of his time teaching Moshe about himself and about what he was offering to his people, and focus on the job at hand, which was liberating them from human bondage and escorting them to the promised land. They would not have to address to nearly the degree the negative influence of religion and politics, because Moshe was already familiar with them. And that's why this man was chosen, even though at the time he was 80 years old, a shepherd with a speech impediment. That tells you a lot about who Yahweh chooses to work with, who he approaches, why he picks one person over another. Even the fact that Yahweh chose to liberate his people with an 80-year-old shepherd. He did not do it alone. God chooses to do almost everything with us and through us, and not independently. And the very reason for this is the reason we exist. The covenant is all about developing a personal, familial relationship with the creator of the universe, where he is our father, we are his children. And so it is his objective, it is his intent, it is his desire to accomplish things with us, to experience life with us, to achieve with us and through us. It's all part of the way a family operates. So Moshe, one who draws out, was shepherding the flock of his father-in-law, Yethro, the Midian, and Midian priest. Midian means one who ministers to the contentious. Midian is like Mirabah. It means contentious. And he led his sheep to the end of the desert wilderness, and he came to Chorob, the mountain of the Almighty. Now, it's interesting even to note why Moshe's father-in-law was a Midian priest. It is because Moshe stayed in character. When he arrived in Arabia, he saw young women being harassed by a group of hoodlums, a gang. And these women were simply trying to give their sheep a drink. Moshe intervened and he protected them. This is an exceptionally good man. And when they young women went back home, they told their father of this marvelous man of character and courage that they had met along the way. And it is because of that that Yethro reached out to him. Yethro, by the way, means remnant. It is from Yathar, to remain. And the spiritual messenger of Yahweh appeared to him by means of a flaming fire from the midst of a rocky crag. Once again, insights to deliberate. Now, I could go directly to Yahweh introducing himself by name, but we're going to review this in context. It's important for you to know the circumstances around which God introduced himself to us through Moshe. It's also important that we glean the teachings and instructions that God provided along the way. That's how we come to know him. It's one thing to recognize his name and to use his name, to acknowledge his name. It's another thing to know who he is, what he's offering, what he expects in return. And we learn these things when we listen to him, observe his testimony in the Torah. So in this case, it was a spiritual messenger, a malach of Yahweh. That tells you a number of things. You see, for God to have created a universe that appears to be six-dimensional, we know it's at least four in space-time, but even then, 94% of the universe is comprised of things that are beyond our comprehension, and we call them dark matter and dark energy. I think they're dimensions. And as such, if the universe is indeed six-dimensional, Yahweh has to be at least seven-dimensional to have conceived it. Now, that's important because a seven-dimensional being cannot enter a six-dimensional construct, just like we cannot enter one of the pictures we draw on a piece of paper. We're a dimension greater than the two of the paper. Yahweh is a dimension greater than the universe he conceived. And so the only way that Yahweh can interact with his creation is either through dispatching an aspect of his energy via the set-apart spirit, for example, sending a spiritual representative like the Malach messengers, or through his words. He can also project his nefesh soul, which is a carrier of his personality and his attributes, and place it inside an avatar, if you will, which he has done on many occasions. These are the ways that Yahweh can interact with us. Of course, Yahweh has introduced himself long before this. It's even in the first chapter of Bereshit, we read God's name, and here it is boldly presented. Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh. It's the proper pronunciation of these four vowels based upon Eloah, which is God's title, directed in his Torah, which is where we know how to pronounce the Wah, because it's T-W-R-H in Hebrew, and also ending in the same Ah sound. And regarding his Haya existence, which is something we're going to learn a lot more about as we proceed in this text, regarding our shalom restoration. I share shalom with you because everybody knows how to pronounce the word, and yet the O sound in shalom comes from the Wah, which is the only letter in God's name that is even controversial. Yahweh. And the spiritual messenger of Yahweh appeared by means of a flaming fire. The reason that God appeared as radiant energy is because light is the closest analog to his nature that we can experience and perceive. God is an energy-based being. We're physical beings. If you understand Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, then you know that energy and matter are the same thing. Therefore, we as physical beings can be made in God's image. It's just that the material world is hugely reduced from energy. That's why E equals the mass times the square of light, the square of the speed of light. So energy and matter are the same things. They're just not the same amount of that same thing. So light is the thing that is most similar to Yahweh. It is eternal. Photon of light time simply exists, which means you can witness the past, the present, and the future simultaneously. The nature of light and time is how prophecy exists. It's how Yahweh gets everything he speaks of correct, both in the past and in the future, is he has experienced our past and our future, and having witnessed our future, he can report in our past and have it put in writing what he has witnessed. It's really speaking of future history. Only he can do that. That's why prophecy is the proof that not only Yahweh exists, but that he inspired the Torah and prophets that we have based the books bearing the Yada brand upon. So he appeared by means of a flaming fire. And from the midst of not a burning bush, but from a rocky crag. It is Sinai. It's a high and shimmering rocky cliff. He looked, this would be Moshe, and behold, that rocky summit was ablaze with the fire, but the crag was not consumed. In other words, there was no appearance of anything that was actually burning. The light simply materialized. God represented his presence through the voice of the Malak messenger and through the image of that blazing fire. This is Shemoth. It means names, which is an appropriate title for a book that introduces Yahweh's name to us. It's been corrupted to Exodus 3:2. Even if you wanted to name the book Exodus, it would be the Hebrew word Yatzah. But the book is actually named Names, Shemoth. Sana is a not a thorny shrub or prickly bush, and written exactly the same way, S-N-H, in Hebrew. Vocalized, therefore, different, but the letters are the same. It means high rocky place, and it's an elevated and shining crag or cliff. Now, while they're indistinguishable in the Hebrew text, one of these terms works in this context, makes sense, and can actually be witnessed when you look at Google Earth and you drill down on the top of Mount Chorab in Arabia. It's across from Nuweiba Beach on the Aqaba crossing. And so, like many who have searched the maps of the land of Midian and have examined the pictures taken in this region, I've seen, and you can see, the rocky heights of Mount Chorab. And since this is the mountain of God and Yahweh is the rock of our salvation, I would opt for shimmering high rocky crag over a thorny bush on this day and any day. Moreover, the spectacle was magnificent, making a crag more reasonable as a venue than a thorny shrub. Moshe said, I want to change direction and to go witness this phenomenally massive sight, Eth Ha Mareth, this enormous spectacle. It is from Ma to question the implications of Ra'ah, that which can be seen, inspected, and considered, which is so enormous, extensive, and intense, wa gadol hazeh. Yeah. Its description proves my point. It was a rocky crag that was ablaze, the top of Mount Chorab, where the Torah was revealed. But how and why? He asked himself. There is nothing to burn on the high, shimmering, rocky crag. Shemoth, Exodus 3:3. When Yahweh saw that indeed he had changed direction to draw near and to see, God called out to him, inviting him to meet with him, Kara, from the midst of the rocky heights. He said, Moshe, Moshe. And so he responded and said, look, here I am. Hina Ani. Shemoth, Exodus 3:4. Kara is the operative term in Mikra. And in the plural, of course, it is Mikre, invitations to be called out and meet. These are the seven annual meetings where we were invited to be called out of this corrupted world of religion and politics and to meet with the Creator God of the universe. The first three of these Mikre, Dod, the actual Messiah and Son of God, fulfilled in your 4000 Yah, 33 CE, providing eternal life, perfection, and adoption into the covenant family, allowing God to enrich and empower us. The fourth of these Mikre is in our immediate future, less than a year and a half from now, on Shavua, a Shabbat, in 2026. Which is the beginning of the time of Jacob's troubles, when things are going to get really nasty for Israel and for Jews worldwide. Then the last three will be fulfilled in succession in your 6,000 yan 2033, beginning with Teruah, followed by the homecoming and family reunion when Dode is the Messiah and the King of God and the Son of God, the King of the universe at that point, returns with Yahweh. And we all camp out together, beginning on Sukkah. This is the story of the Mikre. And so God introduced himself to Moshe by highlighting the verb which underlies his most important meetings. Moshe was perhaps slow in speech, but he was not deaf. There was no reason for Yahweh to repeat his name unless it was essential for us to understand his name. And there's two aspects here. One is that if God's going to use our name, don't you think we should return the favor and use his? And of course, as I've already mentioned, the name Moshe is important because it means to draw out. The purpose of the Torah, the purpose of Moshe, the purpose of the Yatza Exodus, the purpose of the Mikre themselves is to call us out away from the world of religion and politics so that we can be set apart unto Yahweh and become part of his family. It is the first condition of the covenant for us to walk away from all things Babel. So God can manifest himself in any way he chooses, but light, which is eternal in time, enlightening and empowering, is his favorite. We mortals can only come so close, however, to this much energy without the source of life becoming too intense for us in our present state. Such may have been the case here. So there was also a caveat for Moshe. And this is important for us to know as we proceed with the text. So God either said, and there's a variety of different ways to translate this next statement, all of which really are interesting, is that do not come near this place. Then God said, approach and draw near. I don't think that's what he said, because that would be contradictory, wouldn't it? But that's nonetheless what most English Bibles would have you believe. The initial rendition, while consistent with almost all English Bibles, does not work in this context because the last speaker was Moshe, and this is clearly God speaking to him. Therefore, El reveals the change of voice from man to God. Moreover, in his last statement, Wahkara El Hu Elohim, God called out to him, inviting him to meet with him. He would not then say, hey, but go away. No, he's inviting Moshe to approach. Karab only means to approach and come near. It is something Yahweh asks of us during the celebration of the Moed Mikre. Additionally, Halom speaks of being in close proximity. Not only would it have been inconsistent with Yahweh's purpose to send Moshe away, since he intended to spend the next 40 years with him and then all eternity, Moshe would spend 40 days and 40 nights with Yahweh in this very place, on the very summit of Mount Chorib. So, God was there to introduce himself and meet with Moshe to discuss their mission together. They were about to become collaborators and inseparable. And then there's the issue of Ma'al sandals. Why take them off if he was being sent away? How would the ground away from God be special? Even if we were intent on leaving Aleph Lamed as Al rather than El, and they're written the same way in the original Hebrew text, God could have been saying that in spite of the evidence to the contrary, you will not be negated and thus reduced to nothing by the intensity of this powerful force and by approaching. All things considered, I think the following is correct. Then God Almighty said, approach and draw near this place. Now, before we go on, just a word. When I'm sharing a translation with you, it is my own. I've invested the last 23 years learning to translate Hebrew, typically from the oldest extant sources, which would mean the Dead Sea Scrolls. My goal is to convey what God revealed to us as accurately and as completely as possible. The style that I use is called an amplified translation. If you go to yadayah.com, you will find many of them throughout. There's 35 books on the shelf, and they all are based on these amplified translations where I provide the text that I'm sharing with you in bold, and then within the parenthetical, I show the Hebrew word in its generic form that you can copy and paste if you're reading online, which the books are free in their entirety online. You can copy and paste into any search engine and validate that the translation that I'm providing for you is accurate. And then in that parenthetical, I will also expand, amplify, if you will, the translation for greater understanding. And I will always do as I have done here. If there are different ways to handle the text, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to give you what the options are and tell you the reasons I think one choice is better than another. It's like playing a card game where you lay every card face up on the top of the table. I want you to know the truth, and I want you to be able to verify for yourself that it's true. So then God Almighty said, approach and draw near at this place. Take off your sandals from upon your feet, because this place, which to show the benefits of the relationship, which is from Asher, you are standing, Ahmad, upon, is set apart and special. Hugh Kodesh. It is separated from all that is common and ordinary, corrupted by humanity. Ground. Adamah. Insights here as well. Yahweh didn't want Moshe walking away. Take off your sandals. Let's get comfortable. Sit down. You know, you're not going to walk away barefoot. We're going to talk for a while. He also used Kodesh. Kodesh is one of the most misunderstood words in the entire text. It is corrupted to holy when chole in Hebrew is a horrible term. Kodesh means special, uncommon, that which is not ordinary. Well, what is the most ordinary and common human institution throughout all time? The answer is religion. What is the second most? Politics. So to be Kodesh, set apart, is to be disassociated from that which is common and ordinary, and therefore set apart from religion and politics. Even Adamah is important to us, because as we approach Teruah, the final in-gathering, be it September 23rd and 24th in 2033, just 10 days before Yahweh's return with Dod, we are going to find that Yahweh has arranged for the sacrifice of the Adamah Parah. It is rendered a red heifer, but Adamah means ground. It is based on Adam, which means man. It is also defined as red. And so Adamah means bloody red man of the earth. Parah is one who is fruitful and productive. So Adamah Parah, this red heifer, is a bloody red man from the earth who is productive. He is, if you read Yeshayah Isaiah, the man from Edom. And he is speaking to you now. Yahweh wants us to approach him and to be comfortable around him. So God said, yeah, slip off your sandals. This place is home. Mount Chor, the mountain of God, was chosen because it had not been contaminated by men. It was still special and set apart and could serve as Yahweh's makum, his office, the place where he would provide directions for life. And that instruction would include being kum, upright, in his presence, not bowed down. Well, ready and willing to kum, take a stand against that which is common and corrupting. Everything important to God and essential for us is Kodesh, set apart. If something is ordinary and popular, as religion and politics are in Yisrael, they are not of God. He said, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob. This means he is the God of the covenant with Yisrael. Yahweh could simply have said, Mani Elohim, I'm God. And he could have left it at that, but he didn't. It is therefore essential that we recognize the implications of him making this announcement as the Elohim of Abraham, Yishak, and Jacob. They were the initial beneficiaries of the covenant. Two were the descendants of Abraham and Sarah. Jacob became Yisrael. He was the father of the nation of God's people. And they are his people. That's why he introduced himself this way. Now, the fact is, they're the chosen people because Yahweh chose them. Unfortunately, they have not reciprocated, and Jews have not chosen Yahweh in return. In fact, they've been so belligerent, they've erased his name from their lives. I'm sure that all of this was overwhelming, and so Moshe concealed his face because he was awestruck looking at the Almighty. In his office on Mount Chorab, Yahweh got down to business. He laid it on the line, telling Moshe what he already knew. Then Yahweh said, I have witnessed and surely seen the oppression and the persecution of my people who are in the crucibles of oppression, Mitzrayim. It's important to understand this in context. God just said that he has witnessed Oni, oppression and persecution. He has witnessed affliction and suffering, harassment, poverty, misery, and humiliation. And then he associated all of that with Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is a compound of meh, which is a interrogatory. It encourages us to ponder the implications of the plural of sar, mitzarim. And sar is the Hebrew word for trouble, to harass, to subjugate, to persecute. It is also to confine. I spoke a moment ago about the time of Jacob's troubles, the time of Israel's oppression. In that title, sar is used to explain that Israel will be confined, that Israel will be persecuted, and that Israelis will be tormented around the world. Now, when we share all of that, the other insight is that Mitzrayim is not Egypt. Yes, that is the place that is called Egypt today, which there they actually refer themselves as Mitzra, using the same name. But God gave it, this people and place, a name that suited what they had done to his people. They were oppressing his people. It was their religion and their politics and their government, their military, their caste system economically that was subjugating and cruelly tormenting his people. Mitzrayim is the crucibles of political and religious oppression. And that is what Yahweh wanted to liberate, emancipate his people from. He continues, I have heard their cry of distress, their painful and despairing wailing, because the presence of their oppressive taskmasters who are exploiting them. Indeed, I recognize and personally know their pain and suffering. I have heard is from Shammah. All Israelites know Shammah. It means to listen. And as we pursue these words, the verb in the next sentence is yada. It is the name that I chose when I was beginning to share Yahweh's name, reintroducing Yahweh to his people, back to God. It means to know, to understand, to recognize, to be acquainted with, to acknowledge, to be familiar with. And God understood their pain and suffering. There are a number of occasions where God experiences great pain and suffering. And most of it was inflicted by his own people. Well, this is why Yahweh chose Moshe. He was the only man on earth who had witnessed what Yahweh had seen and agreed with God's assessment of this place, of this people, of these conditions. He knew that the religiosity and politics and the caste system and Egypt were wrong. And he was willing to stand up against them. There would be a lot that Yahweh would have to teach Moshe for him to prevail. But there was one subject in which their abhorrence was already shared. Moshe's assessment of Mitzrayim was identical to God's. Yahweh despises religion. Yes, I have written 5 volumes exposing and condemning Islam, Muhammad and Allah, the Quran and Hadith, called Goddamn Religion, because to damn is to separate from, and God is distinct from, opposed to religion. He despises it. And it's because religion and politics are used to owning, oppress and persecute others, afflicting them and causing many to suffer. Man impoverishes while God seeks to enrich. With man there is misery, with God there is mercy. And if you want to know Yahweh, if you want to spend eternity as part of his family and his home, the first step in that direction is to disassociate from religion, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. And then politics, whether it is the conspiratorial patriotic right or the near insane progressive left. Yahweh was rolling out some of the most telling words, of course, in the Hebrew vocabulary to convey his dismay with the consequence of human oppression and persecution. He does not want his people victimized, which is why he is opposed to religion and politics. God was familiar with the anguish of his people. He knew their suffering because he would endure the agony of witnessing his beloved son tortured by the most ruthless empire during Passover. He would suffer as his son carried his people's religious and political guilt into Sheol to resolve this fungus during unyeasted bread. And he would suffer just a matter of days from this moment. When after delivering the Israelites from oppression in Mitzrayim, they would thank him by making a religious idol. Right there at the base of Mount Horeb, the golden calf. And then when God came and decided that he would reinforce that he, in fact, was meeting with and inspiring Moshe so that they could trust what he was telling them. And God called them to gather together so that he could speak to them in their presence. They told God to go away. They never wanted to see him or hear from him again. Talk about pain. Think of the pain that Israel has inflicted upon Yahweh. This needs to change. God said, so I have descended to deliver them from the influence of Mitzrayim, the crucibles of political and religious oppression, and to lift them out of that land to a good land, a spacious land flowing with milk and honey, the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Prezalite, the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. It's often mentioned, but the reason for the reference to milk and honey is that milk is nurturing. It is what a mother provides for her newborn child, for that child to grow. And honey is one of the most enduring substances on earth. You can actually eat honey that was harvested thousands of years ago. And of course, honey is the product of bees, and the Hebrew word for word and bee are exceedingly similar. Now, this would be a rescue mission. Yahweh was committed to lift his people out of man's oppressive religious and political influence, and God was offering to take them to a very good place. What follows is then repeated three times. God's point is that human political and religious schemes burden his people. They are works-based, making them suppressive. Yahweh's solution, which is liberating and uplifting, is the antithesis of man's program. And so now at this time, it is my desire that you choose to go, electing to walk as an expression of my will. Halak, let's go. It was scribed in the call imperative, paragogic, cohortative. Now, that's a mouthful, except it tells us a lot of things. The imperative is second person volition. The cohortative is first person volition. Therefore, the speaker, Yahweh, is conveying his will, what he wants. And the imperative tells us that Moshe could operate under the impetus of free will. God wanted Moshe to want what he desired. And the paragogic just makes this more emphatic. And so let's go now. It is my desire that you choose to go, electing to walk as an expression of my will. I will send you out to Pharaoh to bring out my people, the children of Israel, from the crucibles of oppression. All three names here are a teaching moment. Pharaoh was scribed using the phonetic Hebrew alphabet 3,480 years ago, telling us how to pronounce the name of the Egyptian king, the title of the Egyptian king. Thousands of years before the Rosetta Stone. We can trust what God reveals and the language he chose to convey it. This is one of a thousand evidences. Also, Yisrael is from Ish-Sara-El. Ish is individual, Sarah, who engage and endure, El, with God. And Mitzrayim is, as I have shared it, the crucibles of oppression. Everyone who has served with the Almighty will empathize with Moshe. I have often asked the same question regarding my role in sharing what God revealed through his prophets and through Moshe in particular. You know, surely, God, you can find somebody better. So we read, but Moshe said to the Almighty, oh my, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and actually bring out the children of Israel from the crucibles of oppression? Having lived in and subsequently left Mitzrayim, Moshe was, as I have shared, the only qualified person available on the planet for this mission. Yes, he was really old. Yes, he had a speech impediment. And he was an alleged murderer with a death sentence hanging over his head too. But none of that mattered. God does not work alone. His criteria are considerably different from ours. You know, even with the entire Midian army, Moshe recognized that he was wholly inadequate. This accurate self-assessment, along with his appreciation for the plight of his people, made him an ideal implement. And he had character too, demonstrating that he was ready to risk his own life to protect the oppressed. There aren't many Moshes in the world today. Now, in his case, he wasn't just the best choice. He simply was the only choice. There were no other options. God told us as much when he explained why Moshe had left Mitzrayim. We can learn from, but ought not argue with, Yahweh's rationale when he makes a decision such as this. So while after working with some 40 receptive Israelites since that time, each of whom God inspired as prophets, did Yahweh choose a goy? Especially one who appears so unqualified to share these insights with you. Why did he do so? Obviously, there were thousands of scholars and theologians better educated and equipped to perform this mission of calling his people out of political, religious, and geographic Babylon. Certainly, someone else could accurately and more completely present his testimony, reintroduce his name and his son to his people. While others were not called for a host of reasons, all of which are worth considering. You know, God never works through theologians or PhDs in biblical language because they're engrossed in religion. They earn a living from it. By definition, they are not liberated from this plague and therefore not able to work with God. Second, for a scholar to maintain standing in academia, they must ultimately profess what God detests, a politically correct, inclusive, multicultural, and exceedingly liberal agenda. They cannot serve as liberators because Yahweh's words lead in the opposite direction. Simply stated, theologians and scholars cannot do as God requests without undermining their careers and standing in their religious and academic communities. Third, there is the tendency for the acclaimed and credentialed to remain self-reliant, to be entrenched. And they are far less likely to rely on God. God works with us by enlightening and empowering those who are open and receptive to him. They're not. With the distortions promoted by progressives through politics, academia, and the media, and with rampant anti-Semitism, cancel culture, critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, multiculturalism, feminism, non-binary genders, misandry, democratic socialism, LGBTQIA+, swerf turf, and being woke, I long for a time when the relative stupidity of political correctness was the extent of our issue in knowing and sharing the truth. Slightly ahead of his time, in 1984, George Orwell wrote these words which should pierce our souls. He said, speaking of this time, which is our time, every record has been destroyed or falsified, every book rewritten, Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. And that process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. End quote. And it is the willingness to bow to the revisionist mandates of the politicized left, along with the madness of the religious right, that has narrowed the field such that Yahweh was left with a lone, flawed, but serviceable goy. Well, I have long assumed that I was offered this job per deflatum. Having studied Yahweh's preference, it is also likely that I possessed many attributes that Yahweh wanted to develop. In addition, I had met his prerequisite, because like Moshe, I had experienced and rejected religion and politics by the time he introduced himself and we met a teruah right after 9/11. Such inquiry and introspection, even curiosity, to understand why these things are so, are essential components of our interaction with and communication with God. We should question everything and strive to appreciate why the narratives, which comprise the Torah and prophets, have been provided like this. Our goal ought to be to understand the insights and the lessons which can be deduced from every discussion and ascertain how they apply to us today. Here we teed off on Moshe saying, "Who am I to do this?" Well, I've shared with you who he was, why he was God's pick, so that you might appreciate why I am speaking to you, so that you might know how you too can become valuable to God and serviceable to his people. Considering the speaker, this assurance should have been sufficient. So then he responded, "Indeed, I will be with you." I cannot help but laugh. Even in this most telling of passages, Yahweh inserted something that, well, I find it funny, especially in the light of my own personal inadequacies. While the primary meaning of M is, as I have rendered it, with, alongside, near, and in association with, part of a relationship, it also means in spite of, which I take to mean God will complete his mission in spite of Moshe's failings, or yours, or mine. It is something I have long known, but it's nice to see it in writing nonetheless. Yahweh prefers to do things, even the big things, the biggest things, with us and through us, rather than alone. That's why his son, the Messiah, Dod, fulfilled the biggest of them, Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, in 33 CE, or your 4,000 Yah. Surely, Yahweh could have blasted the so-called Egyptians and then paved a yellow brick road for his people to follow home. But instead, he went with Moshe. Also, God could have written his word on an enormous tablet and held it up in the sky. He could have deployed a Moloch spiritual implement to scribe a word doc on a universal hard drive, putting it on the internet for all to see. But that isn't his style. In spite of us, he seems to enjoy our company. It is, after all, the very reason we exist. And God said, "And this is your sign, that indeed I myself have sent you. When you come out with the people from the crucibles of oppression, you will work with God upon this specific mountain." God loves to come full circle. That which is will be. One of the great examples. We're told marvelous things about the conditions that existed in Gan Eden, the Garden of Great Joy. And the reason that God's interaction with Adam is so well, the narrative is so interesting, robust, is that that's where we're headed. That is where the Moed Mikre take us. We walk through the doorway of Pesach. We're cleansed on the threshold of matzah. We enter God's home as his children, adopted, paper signed on Bukurim, so that we are transformed into light as we enter Shamayim on Shabuah. And on future programs, I'll tell you all about what's going to happen on Teruah, such that a remnant of God's people, as well as the returning covenant family, can witness and enjoy and celebrate the homecoming and the family reunion on Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliation, so that we can all camp out with Yahweh. In other words, sukkah, camping out, shelters, is about a returning to Eden. God says this over and over again, that he is going to restore the earth that man has polluted and corrupted with his religions, with his politics, with his militaries, with his conspiracies. And it's going to return to the conditions found in Eden. And so if you want to know what life with God's going to be like, study the garden. Well, I'll do a series of shows on that as well, because it's important for us to understand. Moshe, with a considerable assist from God, led his people out of Egypt, directly across the Red Sea, into Arabia, and back to Mount Horeb. Having returned to this place, Moshe continued to work with Yahweh. Together, they would reveal the Torah, God's teaching and guidance. The affirmation that God is going to accompany Moshe on this mission was evidently good enough for our reluctant liberator, as it should be for any one of us. Therefore, there was only one thing left that had to be resolved. The Egyptians, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Phoenicians, the Minoans, the Carthaginians, the Babylonians, and the Assyrians had a plethora of gods, all of which had names, and all of which had been credited for all manner of human endeavors. Moshe knew that the first question he would be asked was, "What is your name?" And Moshe said to God, "Now look, if I go to the children of Israel and I say to them, 'The God of your fathers sent me out to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his personal and proper name?' What shall I say to them?" You know, if I were to ask 1,000 Jews whether they live in America, Europe, or Israel, the question that Moshe just asked, not even 1% of them would know the answer. And not one in 100,000 of them, even if they knew the answer, would say it. God's name is hated by his people. That's why I said, God chose you. You did not choose him. You did not reciprocate. You erased his name from your lives. It was the worst thing you've ever done. Well, this is the most important mission a man or a woman can ever undertake, reaching out to the children of Israel at Yahweh's behest. It is the most important question a man can ask. What should I tell them is God's personal and proper name? If you know his name, you can differentiate him from the gods of religion. You can say, Yahweh is not Jesus Christ. Yahweh is not Hashem. Yahweh is not the Lord. Yahweh is not Allah. Yahweh is Yahweh. Yahweh is the author of the Torah, of the Navi prophets, and of the Mizmor songs. He is the creator God of the universe. And he is completely different than the gods men have made through the religions. Now many may seek the will of God for their lives. And yet, here it is for the accepting. Many declare that they want to know God, and yet here is an engraved invitation. Now, while God would give Moshe a direct answer, he did not do so immediately. This is his approach to almost everything. His preference is to teach that things that we need to know so that we go beyond knowing once we begin to make the connections with all that he has shared and we reach the point of understanding. Not willing to invest the time to go to the next step, we humans have come to know many things, but understanding remains elusive. And without the proper perspective, without making the appropriate connections, without a discriminating filter, too much information can be distracting, it can be disorienting, it can even be misleading. This is the undercurrent supporting religion, politics, patriotism, militarism, and conspiracy. Knowing isolated things, but not making the connection between them and being able to discern fact from fiction. Yes, God wants us to know his name, but far more than this, he wants us to understand his name. There's a bigger difference between Amun-Ra, Amun, Aton, Horus, Seb, Isis, Osiris, Sobek, et al., and Yahweh than just his name. Yahweh is for real. He created man, and man created each of these imposters. By revealing the basis of his name, Yahweh explained its meaning, as well as how to pronounce it. So God said to Moshe, the one who draws out, I am Haya, showing the way to the benefits of the relationship because, Asher, I am the Haya. Yahweh is based upon the vowels which comprise Haya, meaning to exist. It provides all but one of the four letters in God's name, even replicating the presentation of the two Hays, just as is the case in Yahweh's name. The order is different, with the opening Hay removed from or moved to the conclusion of his name, which essentially makes Yahweh's name feminine. There is only the addition of the Wah in the midst of Yahweh that could be even the least bit controversial. But yet it's the most commonly used letter throughout the Torah, and also the first word in God's answer, Wah. It means and, then, so, in addition, to increase, to include, to associate, the next series of related things. A Wah is about making connections, which lead to profound insights. It is by Wah bringing related things together that comprehension becomes possible as we move from knowing to understanding. Haya can be translated as has been, was, am, will be, and become. To exist, to occur, to happen, and to transpire, to take place, to come about, and to abide. Haya appears over 3,500 times in the Hebrew text, almost always in the call stem, denoting a genuine relationship, which should be interpreted literally. No one disputes how to pronounce Haya. No one should dispute how to pronounce Yahweh. Asher is one of the most intriguing words in all of the Hebrew lexicon. It can be translated as simply as who, which, with, where, when, or so that. But it is best understood when rendered as it is in God's declarative statement. My preference is to translate Asher under its verbal root, which is to show the steps along the way which lead to the benefits and blessing of the relationship. It guides us along the correct, albeit narrow and restrictive path, to get the most enjoyment out of living an upright life. As is the case with Wah, Asher exists to establish a relationship between things, making a comparison. It conveys a relevant and relative reference, resulting in a better understanding of Yahweh's message in this case. Asher can serve as a particle, as a conjunction, as a noun, as a name, and of course as a verb. Asher is devoted to the relationship. It is for our benefit. It exists to show the way, and it serves as a blessing. Yahweh's answer conveys all of the following. I exist, I was, I am, and I always will be. I am God. I am responsible for your very existence. I am the source of your continued existence. I am exactly who I say I am. Therefore, by using these three words, God told us he actually exists, that our continued existence is predicated upon him, that relationships are of vital interest to him. And he told us how to pronounce his name. Yahweh's from Haya. And then he said, tell this to the children of Yisrael. I am has sent me to you. There's no higher authority. There's no greater calling. The source of our existence, the only God who actually exists, would travel from Mount Choreb in Arabia to the Nile Delta and back again with an 80-year-old stuttering shepherd to rescue his wayward and irascible children from the most oppressive religious, political, and military power man had yet conceived. Certainly God keeps it interesting. It has been said so many times that we can be certain Yahweh wants everyone to know that he was on a mission. His mission was to liberate his people, the children of Yisrael. He did not want to lord over them. He did not want them to obey him. He wanted to emancipate them. And specifically from the institutionalization of religion and politics. God was not issuing a command, delineating a set of laws, or asking anyone for obedience. He was instead freeing Israel from bondage. And that is a stunning blow to Orthodox Jews, Christians, and Muslims, who have all sought to oppress Yehudim, either with their debilitating laws, their ruthless persecution, or genocidal rage. When such institutions stand in direct opposition to Yahweh, we can be assured that God despises them and will ultimately destroy them, cleansing the planet to return us back to the conditions in Eden. Those who promote the myth that God's name isn't known, that it isn't important, that it cannot and should not be pronounced, stop reading at this point. God was not finished speaking. Shemoth names 3:13 and 3:14 are Yahweh's marvelous ways of telling us exactly how to spell and speak his name, even comprehend his name. This was not a random diatribe. Ihaya Asher Ihaya reveals the basis of Yahweh's name, the meaning of Yahweh's name, even the proper pronunciation of Yahweh's name. He has already left us without excuse. And yet, he was not done talking. And furthermore, God declared to Moshe, you should say this to the children of Yisrael, Yahweh, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my personal and proper name forever. Yahweh, God of your fathers, God of Abraham, the God of Yishak, the God of Jacob, therefore the God of the covenant, has sent me to you. This is my name for all time. This is the way I want to be remembered throughout every generation and dwelling place. Shemoth names, Exodus 3:15. There's no way to argue with that. There is no but. There is no, but tradition teaches us otherwise. The rabbis say this. Nonsense. God spoke. He conveyed his name in his Torah to Moshe. Don't you believe him? Don't you trust him? You think he knows his name? Yahweh is God's name. Yahweh has been and always be God's one and only name. It does not matter who you are, what language you speak, or where you live. He does care what you call him. If you know God, you refer to him as Yahweh. By contrast, if you are not using Yahweh's name, God is not listening to you. He does not know you, and he has no interest in you. Your worship, your praise, your prayers are a colossal waste of time. Yahweh is the one who established the covenant, doing so with Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. Yahweh is our liberator and savior. Yahweh is the name Moshe used to deliver the children of Israel. God has no other name. The covenant has no other sponsor. There is none other. This has been the Yahweh Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn. I wish you a wonderful Shabbat and good night. Shalom, Yisrael.